Don't be silly. You're taking the fall.
My name is Stephen Nestor, and you're listening to Poets of the Tabloid Murder. Today we have with us Chelsea Kane, author of Nancy Drew Tells All, Confessions of a Teen Sleuth. Chelsea, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Stephen.
Chelsea, you've written a parody, obviously, of the beloved Nancy Drew, a girl who many, many women have grown up reading in their preteens and their teens, and you've kept Nancy Drew alive. And what was it that inspired you to take this antiquated female sleuth?
Antiquated? That's the exception of that.
Why?
No, I'm kidding. I was a zealot as a kid, a Nancy Drew zealot. I loved her and read Nancy Drew books over and over and over again and carried little yellow hardbacks with me wherever I went. I read them under the desk at school. And a few years ago, there were all these books coming out that kind of took a different look at some well-known novel, like The Wind Undone, and Ahab's Wife. And I was fascinated by that approach, you know, to take a book that you loved as a writer and to rewrite it from another character's perspective. As a reader, I was totally offended by it, but as a writer, I was completely fascinated. And I thought, you know, what would I do? What book has been so important in my life that I would actually want to sit down and revisit it as a writer and take it apart and, you know, and spend a year with it, basically, in that universe? And I immediately thought of Nancy Drew because, you know, she's the most influential female character in American literature. And I decided that it would be fun to write her perspective as opposed to Carolyn Keene, who was, you know, the supposed writer of the books and, in fact, was just a name that the ghostwriters used.
And there were so many Nancy Drew volumes that came out. I mean, there had to be at least over 50. And we're just talking about the first before the successive updates were done of Nancy Drew. I mean, let's talk a bit about Edward Stratemeyer, if we can, just to give our listeners a little bit of history of Nancy Drew, and of course the Hardy Boys make an appearance, and of course my good friend Tom Swift is in there. But what you're dealing with is basically like a publishing dynasty of teenage pulp books. And tell us a little bit about Edward Stratemeyer. Was he as real as say Franklin W. Dixon and Carolyn Keene, or was he a figment of somebody's imagination?
He was real, as far as we know. But yeah, he was a man with a dream. You know, he had this idea of mass producing children's adventure stories, and did that, and came up with the idea of Nancy Drew, and wrote some outlines, and then had writers write them. The first writer being Mildred Ward Benson, who was a writer in Iowa, who actually wrote the first couple Nancy Drew books under the pen name Carolyn Keene. And then from then on, anyone, you know, who would write either from his outline or, in fact, his daughter, who ended up taking over the syndicate, as they called it, and ended up writing a lot of the other outlines, and some people think actually writing some of the books, so that's debatable. And the Stratemeyer syndicate is responsible, yeah, for the Hardy Boys and Tom Swift and pretty much, you know, all of them, most of the children's adventure books that most of us grew up reading, they had some involvement with.
And I'm gonna assume that you're a child of the '60s.
I was born in '72. So my parents were hippies, though. So in that sense, I was.
Okay. Well, your parents were hippies. They brought you up as kind of like a '70s hippie. So you are a child of a grandchild of the '60s.
Okay. Something like that.
Okay, and you kind of grew up at. We know Nancy Drew and the rest of the Stratemeyer syndicate books went through revisions. Like there was a 1910 Tom Swift, and the Swift who came out in the 20s, and the Swift who came out in the 50s and the 60s was big. But was there a 60s edition of Nancy Drew that or a 70s that you were able to grow up on? I mean, or were you reading the ones about you know, Nancy Drew driving her Model A Roadster? And
I read them all. There were the Nancy Drew mystery stories, which were the first 56 books, and those all came out starting in 1930, and then they were reissued in the 60s and 70s, and those are the yellow hardbacks that a lot of people know. And they were updated. They took out a lot of the ethnic stereotyping. But they also kind of smoothed it down a bit. I mean, they took out a lot of the details and a lot of the pluck that I think made the first generation of books so great. But as a kid, I knew no difference. I loved them all. And in fact, I didn't have a sense that they were the same books that had merely been updated. I thought they were entirely different books and that she just went on a lot of adventures that were very, very similar.
Well, I liked one thing I mentioned is and get into is a way you've taken Nancy Drew, and we meet her in the 20s, and we see Nancy Drew age, turn into a young woman, get married, have a child, and we see her get on into her old age. I mean, you update Nancy Drew for us, which I thought was kind of cool. You've made her relevant, as you say. How did you put it? You put it real nice in your book. You made her a reflection of the times that she grew up in,
uh-huh.
or the times she existed. And you're able to do that through each decade, which I thought was pretty cool.
It was fun having her interact with different eras, for sure. And I tried to have an adventure. The book is basically 10 adventures that she goes on throughout her life in different eras. And it was, the main problem I had when I sat down to write this book, which is a parody, with how to make it sustain itself, I mean, I knew I could make a funny chapter, but what do you do after 15 pages?
Well, that's the genius of Chelsea Kane right there.
Oh, stop.
Okay.
that was the key for me, is to think of it as Nancy Drew, interacting with Nancy Drew in Haight-Ashbury, I mean, how could you not make that work?
Yeah, let's not get ahead of ourselves. Hey, I'm the guy. I'm the one who cracks the jokes here. Okay.
Oh, sorry.
It's okay.
You can edit that out.
No, I'm gonna let you stay in nice and raw, just so your fans know what you're really all about. But I mean, one thing you kept consistent was, was the action in the book. I mean, there was so much action. I was reading so fast, my eyeballs got whiplash from
it. That was for me as a 10-year-old.
But which is great. But Nancy Drew is forever saying jeepers and golly, and even as an old lady on a 1990s new age cruise ship adventure,
uh-huh.
I mean, she basically, even though she is updated to the times, she really is the same person. She's really kind of a hokey girl from where is she from? River Heights, Ohio.
River Heights, Illinois.
Just Illinois, just outside of Peoria.
That's right.
And who was you've updated the book a lot for people out there and. You have her. She's kind of a starry-eyed admirer of Frank Hardy. Now, didn't they really meet in the original Stratemeyer books?
Well, they had some crossover books later, but they didn't meet in any of the originals. They were very separate. They were the same universe, but they were very separate stories.
And what a strange universe that is.
Yeah, but once I accepted the fact that Nancy Drew had existed, I had to accept the fact that all of these other teen sleuths had existed as well. I mean, that was part of the fun, then, is to have her run into all of these people.
That's right. If you believe in Star Trek, then there's got to be Vulcans, right?
Absolutely, yeah. You can't just piecemeal it. So she runs into the Hardy Boys and Tom Swift and Christopher Cool and Cherry Ames and Encyclopedia Brown, Trixie Belden, or her daughter, anyway. So.
Yeah, I enjoyed meeting Encyclopedia Brown, just if I can move ahead in the book.
Yeah.
We don't have to discuss it chronologically. We can just free associate here.
Sure.
That's the beauty of Poets of the Tabloid Murder. But I was a fan of Encyclopedia Brown as a kid. I thought he was really clever. He was pretty smart,
Yeah, I'm surprised you weren't offended by his portrayal, Stephen.
Yeah, but as I am, if I can continue,
uh-huh.
I want to say that you portrayed him as kind of a homosexual mama's boy nerd.
I think you're reading into the homosexuality there, my friend.
No, I want to tell you something, because there's a strain of homosexuality. Not that I have a problem with that, but it runs through the book, and I'm talking about especially lesbianism.
There is that.
which was, and quite honestly, which is which you were able to turn around and make it humorous without making fun of it, okay?
Oh, right. Well, what I hoped to kind of parody there is the fact that in the original books, George, who is one of Nancy Drew's best chums, is described as a tomboy who loved her boy's name, and it's sort of been a running joke, for many, many years that George was a lesbian. And I thought it would be fun to accept that, that she was gay, but to have Nancy remain completely clueless, as she is clueless in the original book.
Mm-hmm. Which is cool. And she pretty much remains clueless about sexuality throughout the entire book, except for kind of her own.
Right. She's got sort of, burning loins for Frank.
Yeah, and burn they did. Would it be... would we be getting ahead of ourselves and perhaps giving too much away if we discussed how burning those loins were?
No, let's do it. Go ahead.
No, you do it. It was your idea. You wrote the book. What happens? Burn, loins. Burn, I say.
No, I mean, Nancy Drew, you know, as you mentioned, definitely keeps a flame burning in her heart for Frank Hardy. And I have to admit that that might have something to do with the crush I had as a child on Parker Stevenson, who played Frank Hardy in the brief TV show
about
the Hardy Boys.
Wow, you are a nerd.
I know. So definitely, you know, some of my childhood fantasies are playing into that. Although Nancy does end up marrying Ned Nickerson, who was her very square but erstwhile boyfriend in the Nancy Drew book.
I know. Ned was kind of like the girls. I think there's like a safety valve guy in every woman's life.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether every woman marries the safety valve guy. Some do, and Nancy did.
She did. He was her special friend.
Yeah, that's right. And what was interesting is that she has a child. She has Frank's love child.
She does.
And which is interesting. And Frank, we'll get to Frank's reaction to that in a minute. But then she marries Ned. Ned's totally clueless.
Yep.
He has no idea that it's not his son. But I think doesn't he realize it at the end of the book, though?
Well, you know, there's a sense that maybe he knew on some level all along. But he loves Nancy. You know, he's always there for her. And that is the beauty of Ned Nickerson.
And he loves her so much that, you know, in the 60s, when, you know, people's value systems were kind of shaken to the core. Nancy and Ned granted Nancy a divorce, but he remained in love with her, and then they kind of reunite for a while, don't they?
They do, yeah. They become special friends again, which is sort of how their relationship is meant to be, because that's how it was in the book.
I know, wink, wink.
Yeah.
And then of course, Nancy and... I mean, I don't think we're giving too much away if we talk about what happens in the book, because even though we tell what happens... In the book, it's you kind of have to read it to experience, because that's where the...
Yeah, it's not about plot.
Yeah, thank you. That's what I meant to say. It's not about plot.
No.
And Nancy, you know, she's like a gray-haired old lady, ends up with good old Frank, and there's still more action to be had in the book. I mean, they're about to go on another adventure.
Yeah.
Nancy and Frank. And tell me, you know, this is a parody. I don't think, you know, like Jonathan Swift didn't write Gulliver's Travels Part 2, but, you know... Could this? I mean, you wrote a parody of a book series. I mean, could you have another installment in this parody?
I think I've exhausted it. I really, really do. I mean, I could maybe follow one of the other sleuths. You know, I could write maybe a parody about Cherry Ames, student nurse.
Yeah, I know you had a pretty funny section in there about Cherry Ames.
Yeah, who was you know, for listeners maybe who aren't aware of her, she was a nurse and had many, many, many books, many dozens of books, in which she had a different job. You know, in each book she would be the cruise ship nurse or the ranch nurse, you know, the army nurse.
I know. Well, at the Seven Sisters mystery of the Seven Sisters, which of course we know is, we're going to pretend this. The girls are at Smith College. This is in the 70s feminism chapter.
Uh-huh.
You really give Cherry a hard time because you're telling, well, you're not a good role model. You can't even hold down a job. Dude ranch nurse, cruise nurse, private duty nurse, army nurse, rest home nurse, ski nurse, you know, one right after another. And, man, does Cherry get ticked off.
Again, my childhood prejudice is showing through. I never liked Cherry Ames. I never got her. You know, she didn't have any sort of big adventures at all. She never... tracked down stolen heirlooms or, you know, found the code in the tapestry. So I resented her and found her to be a perfect nemesis for Nancy Drew.
Yeah, but she sounds like such a firecracker.
She was a firecracker. It's true. And I went back and I, you know, for the book, I researched a lot of these characters and actually went back and reread a lot of these books. And,
how many did you have to go through to get the, was it hard to get the rhythm of the action? Because all the books really... aside from the material that you cover in parody, the writing style is consistent. It is as it was written in the Nancy Drew books. With the action happens quickly. All the mannerisms of the characters are there. That your diction in usage is just as it should be. But
I definitely would have to get the voice in my head, and once I had it, it was there, because I read so many of these books. I wrote like that, you know, until I was about 15, because it was so ingrained in my cerebellum style of writing.
Well, finally it pays off.
Yeah, exactly. all this wasted hours as a kid.
No, no. I was reading somewhere that about. It's funny that you mentioned that. I was reading about Terry Southern, the writer Terry
yeah.
Southern, and it says that he was as a kid he would take a Hawthorne book or a Melville book, and he would write his own stories in their style,
uh-huh.
using their diction, their phrasing, their usage, so on and so forth. And that's how he got that really that incredible literate style of his. So you
uh-huh.
kind of did the same thing, only with a role model, you know, further down on the evolutionary literary scale.
Right.
But it works. But it's okay.
And I think I think it's a great exercise as a writer, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess that's what I was trying to say. And we are speaking with Chelsea Kane, author of Nancy Drew Tells All: Confessions of a Teen Sleuth. Okay, let's get to the Congolese puppet. You've got some really cool capers in here. Things that are just so seem to be so original to what Carolyn Keene, whomever she is, whoever uh-huh. she is, would have written. And it must have been, how much fun was it to go back and say, you know, I'm gonna write a mystery that takes place with Nazi spies and Congolese puppets and Frank Hardy. Tom Swift's going to pick up Frank Hardy and the Sky Queen along with Nancy Drew. They're going to parachute behind enemy lines to pick up Joe Hardy, who's been kidnapped, but it's really a trap. And, you know, how much fun was it to sit there and dream this up?
It was the most fun I've ever had writing anything, definitely. Because, it's such a Valentine to my childhood. You know, it's just all the stuff that we spend so many hours as a kid daydreaming about, only I got to sit down and write it down and make it happen.
You know, I think you're kind of lucky, because even though you seem to have grown up in a not only in a very literate household, but one that kind of had some type of value and some type of adherence or observance of you know, preteen literary tradition.
Uh-huh.
You know, because I really, my sister, who's a year older than me, I know she had some Nancy Drew books, and I don't think she read them. I read a couple of the Hardy Boys books, but, you know, even reading these books like in the 60s, they were kind of dated. But I think you were kind of lucky in having that, where you and maybe plus the interest to read it, that you actually had parents who might have sat you down and got you started with these books. Is that how it happened with you?
Yeah, and my parents were hippies. I actually spent my early childhood on a hippie commune, and I think a big part of the hippie ethos was creativity, you know, and really valuing that and trying to fan that flame. So there were no limitations on books. You know, I mean, I could always read whatever I wanted, and there was a great freedom to that. And I could always spend as much time as I wanted reading, and there was a great freedom to that. And I think that that definitely is what made a writer out of me. And I think, you know, talking to other writers I know, a lot of them have the same memories of Nancy Drew, this sort of obsessive, compulsive reading of those books. So I think that, you know, if you scratch a female writer, you're bound to find a little girl who read a lot of Nancy Drew books as a kid.
And let me just flip sides here. I mean, if your parents were hippies, and didn't they kind of look at Nancy Drew as like the kind of like bourgeois writing and sexist and antiquated and, you know, just uncool? Or they were just happy that their little girl was reading a book?
Yeah, they were happy that I was reading. And I think, I mean, one of the, I think, remarkable things about Nancy Drew and what made her such a global phenomenon is that those books are so sort of blank. You know, Nancy Drew was such a blank character. That we were all able to sort of project a lot onto her. So even though I was living this very bohemian lifestyle as a kid and reading about this girl who had a very upper middle class demeanor in this, you know, town and life that was completely different than mine, I was able to relate to her on some level that, was far more profound than the differences between us.
And let's get back to something that's kind of, we'll get to something that's really kind of a, interests me is that you have in the original series, Nancy Drew's mother kind of, she died when Nancy Drew was three, right?
Right.
And you brought a very, and this is what I admire about what writers can do. You've just brought such a creative and seamless resolution to that problem, and, you know, put it so seamlessly into the plot that, you know, you could be Carolyn Keene. You know, but it was just fantastic. And would you tell us about that? Because I thought that was kind of sensitive, and it was a little bit serious. But I thought it was one of the more remarkable passages in the book.
Oh, thank you, Stephen. That's my favorite chapter. And yeah, Nancy Drew, like, I mean, so many heroines in children's literature have dead mothers because it just makes them easier to deal with, because otherwise we're wondering why the mother, you know, isn't protecting the child from her adventures. And, you know, once I accepted that Nancy Drew had really existed, it called into question everything that Carolyn Keene had told us about her life. And so I thought, well, you know, what if her mother didn't die when she was three? And so at one point in the book, Carson Drew, Nancy's world-famous attorney father, calls her into his office and says, you know, in fact, that that he had lied and that Nancy's mother had not died and that she was alive and that he wants to marry this legal assistant he's had, and so he wants Nancy to find her mother for him so that he can get a divorce. And Nancy, you know, just sort of flushed with excitement at a new mystery and also, you know, delighted at the notion that her mother might still be alive, heads to Los Angeles in the early 40s to find her mother. That was when where her mother was last spotted. Hooks up with Cherry Ames, who was working as a nurse in the area, and they go on this adventure looking for Nancy's mother, and end up finding her, or almost finding her, tracking her to an internment camp, a Japanese internment camp, where Nancy's mother has been living as a, quote, Oriental, end quote, to be with a man she loves, who is Japanese. And they arrive at the internment camp with the hopes of a great rendezvous and reunion, and are thwarted. So I won't tell you exactly what happens.
Right, but you really, it's funny, because you really kind of stick at the Cherry in that chapter.
Uh-huh.
Because Nancy Drew bumps into this handsome older stranger and knocks him unconscious. And he might have been drunk. An elderly gentleman had collapsed! Exclamation point, as you say. And then Cherry rushes to his side, you know, and is going to help the guy. And they meet this man, you know, Nancy, God forbid, gets arrested.
Right.
But they meet up with this man at the end of the chapter, and, you know, he kind of brings everything all together, you know, which is that kind of, it's that simple-minded serendipity that, you know, I think is what attracts readers about this book. We know it's kind of foolish, but for all these loose ends to come together so, you know, so quickly and so perfectly, but we just love it when they do.
Right, and it's so true to this book, you know, which were sort of absurdly, the cliches and sort of verbal tics of all of those books, I think, are so familiar to people, even people like you who maybe only read a couple Hardy Boys as a kid. As soon as you start reading them again, I think it's familiar enough that you're willing to kind of surrender to the universe. I hope so, anyway.
Yeah, and one of the, of all the time periods and people who populated them, for instance, the beatniks of the 50s, hippies of the 60s, new age people of the 90s, I think the guys who take the biggest drubbing are in the... In the Congolese puppet chapter, because you really stick it to these Ivy League CIA kind of guys in, you know, 1959, and because you've got an organization named Teen, and you've got, you know, holy cow, you've got, like, you know, coups in Africa, and, you know, the CIA slithering around, and it's really kind of interesting how you put that all together. But I thought you were really, you know, you got the Soviets, and, you know, with their skullduggery. I thought you really, if anybody who you really stuck it to, it was these Ivy League, you know, straight-laced kind of guys. Why was that?
Well, I thought, I really wanted to have Nancy kind of, whose her whole sort of adventuring universe was so just quaint. I wanted her to kind of run into real-world adventuring and espionage, you know, which is, you know, sort of vicious, and there are a lot of turncoats, and... a lot of really bad business, nothing like her world in River Heights. And so I had her adventure with Christopher Cool, who was, in fact, you know, real. He had his own series of books by Jack Lancer. and he was a teen operative for the CIA. 19 years old, he and his roommate Geronimo Johnson worked for the CIA in these books, which are actually pretty good. But I thought it would be fun to have her go on a, you know, real CIA adventure, you know, which at that time, I mean, you know, we were pulling all sorts of crap all over the world, and kind of get a sense of what was really going on, and then have her react, you know, with this sort of self-righteous indignation, which I think that she would have at some of the tactics that these people were using in the name of Team Sleuthdom.
And not only that, but you've got Nancy playing the politically correct devil's advocate with this fellow Geronimo, and Geronimo's he's a Native American, Geronimo Johnson, And you've got the CIA kid named Chris, who always seems to drive a Jaguar. Pretty soon you've got Nancy giving Chris a hard time about calling Geronimo by, because Chris is calling him by, you know, these casual racist terms, you know.
Right.
Now, I mean, and so Nancy's kind of ahead of her time right there. I got to give her credit for that, because usually she's just kind of stuck in this mental time warp where she's the same old Nancy Drew, and she rarely doesn't kind of update her attitudes. But here you got her ahead of the curve, and I kind of admire that.
Yeah, she gets her ire up.
Pardon me?
She gets her ire up.
Yeah,
you know?
She gets ticked off about that.
Yeah.
And there's something afoot here in the publishing world, because you have to be brief about it, you've got in the Haight-Ashbury chapter, you've got a girl by the name of Foxy Belden.
Uh-huh.
Now, that happens to be Trixie Belden, who was another Stratemeyer teen sleuth. That's her runaway daughter.
Right.
And you stick her right in the book. Well, it just so happens, like a couple of weeks ago, they're reissuing Trixie Belden, because they've been sending me to review Trixie Belden books, which I just can't, you know, I couldn't stomach reading them. I mean,
it seems like a bad fit.
It wasn't working. It just wasn't working. I think now if you're going to bring back these books, you really have to update them, or you're just going to have to, you know, out and out make fun of them like you did.
Uh-huh. So, yeah, I mean, I'm interested. I mean, I would be interested at it, like a 10-year-old today reading these books and how she would respond.
I know. Well, my daughter reads like Angel Juan and Angel John, I think it's pronounced. It's, you know, I think a pretty advanced book for a 13-year-old girl, a woman who has a menage a trois with two gay men and ends up with a child and doesn't know whose it is. You know, she was reading this book for a couple of weeks, and then I finally read in the New York Times about this author and what the books were about, and I almost gagged.
Uh-huh.
But it was too late. I couldn't take the book away from her, so I just played it cool.
Uh-huh, good.
And, well, what does she do? She goes out and buys more books by this author. But I read part of the book. They are very good.
Yeah, they sound a little more sophisticated than Nancy and her friends.
But that's okay. This is your third book. I mean, you've written the Hippie Handbook. You've written a memoir, Dharma Girl. You've edited an anthology, Wild Child, about children of the counterculture. Now you've kind of went back and revisited your childhood again.
Yeah, you can see the thread, can't you?
Yeah, in fictional form. When are you going to grow up and write a book for big kids like us?
You know, honestly, my next book is called Pop Psychology for Superheroes, so I think not anytime soon is the answer to that question.
Well, I think it must be due to the fact that you're a humorist and you can't take anything seriously.
Maybe. I think I'm just arrested.
Well, that's okay. It's working so far.
So far.
And would you ever consider writing, you know, a book that somehow reflects the time in which it was written, you know, in a serious manner?
And I'm trying to write a thriller, like, you know, grown-up Nancy Drew book.
All right.
I'm about halfway through, though, and that's where it gets hard, thrillers, I've noticed, about halfway through. Then you've got to wrap everything up.
Well, why don't you take on the Hardy Boys or Tom Swift? I love Tom Swift.
Should I do, like, a serious update of Tom Swift? Or should I do a parody?
It's a parody, because, you know, when you whipped out the Sky Queen, uh-huh. that really was a Tom Swift thing.
Set your heart aflutter.
Yeah, it did. It did. I like Tom Swift. He was unstoppable. Him and what was his friend's name again?
Bud Barclay.
Bud Barclay.
Yeah, he dies in Vietnam, in my book.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you for reminding me. And they also had a cook. What was the cook's name? Some big Texas.
I don't remember.
I think his name was Butch, who's a big Texas guy. He was always cooking food.
Uh-huh. Well, they were great. The Tom Swift books, I think, are ripe for parody, too, because they have so much just absurd, hyper-scientific language.
I know, but listen, Chelsea, thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, thank you.
And, you know, I've got some good news and I've got some bad news. If you want to come back on the show, you're going to have to write some kind of crime book, because that's what I do. But
Well, the thriller would be right up your alley.
Well, that's what I'm
doing what I can.
That's what I'm talking about. You
okay.
know, the bad news is you got to write. If you don't write one of these books, you won't be on the show. But it sounds like you might be doing that. So let us know what you've been up to, or let us know when the new book comes out, and we'll see whether we can fit you in.
Okay, thanks.
Whether it meets the Poets of the Tabloid murder criteria.
I'll keep my fingers crossed.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Chelsea Kane, author of Nancy Drew Tells All: Confessions of a Teen Sleuth. This is a Bloomsbury book. My name is Stephen Nestor, and you've been listening to Poets of the Tabloid Murder.